You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the 18th to the 24th of September 2014. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by Deputy Features Editor Paul Jump and reporters Holly Else and Jack Grove. The scale of proposed reforms to the university's superannuation pension scheme could result in losses of more than £20,000 a year for academics. No wonder those changes are proving so unpopular. Jack will have more on that in a second. Industry-funded clinical trials are set up more quickly than those financed by medical research charities, research councils and the EU. Holly has more on that story in a second. What can be done about financing taught postgraduate study? Paul's cover feature this week looks at financing master's courses. And the 2015 Best University Workplace Survey is now live. But academics in which discipline most feel their jobs deny them a healthy work-life balance? We've got a little bit on that in this week's issue too. That's from last year's survey. But do go along to timeshighereducation.co.uk/best-uni-workplace to take part in this year's survey. But first up, pensions, Jack. Always a pretty emotive issue. You've been running some figures to work out how the changes to the superannuation scheme will impact academics. Proposed changes, I should
yes,
say. Yes,
these changes have been put forward by Universities UK in a consultation document that is currently being circulated among universities, and that will conclude next week and negotiations will begin. But the UUK proposals are quite drastic, and using the figures in that document, we've been running our own modelling to see how it would affect some academics. And in some cases, academics who are in the final salary pension scheme could have their pensions almost halved, and that's quite a drastic cut, really.
Yeah.
That's basically because the final salary scheme is very generous for those who do well later on in their career, who sort of hit professor or go into senior management, and they do best out of the current scheme. And that's partly why the scheme is unaffordable, some people say. And so these plans from UUK, which will be put to the USS and UCU, these are basically going to hit those people, those high earners, hardest. People who sort of chug along at a lecture and finish at maybe senior lecturer, they won't be hit so hard. But these are quite drastic plans. I don't think anyone was really expecting some of the figures that we're seeing here.
Yeah, okay. I mean, you picked out four case studies. You'll see them all as part of the story on page six this week. But one of the examples, Professor Smith earns £80,000 a year. He's 47 and works until he's 67. His existing final salary scheme amount would be £43,000 a year, plus a lump sum of about £130,000. The new hybrid scheme would see that drop to £38,000 a year with the same lump sum. So, they're still big figures, aren't they? I mean, that's what strikes me. I mean, obviously, we're not in the university's pension scheme. And you look at that and you think, well, he's going to be getting £38,000 a year plus a really sort of fairly hefty lump sum on retirement.
That's true, but that's the scheme that's been in place for forever, since the USS was set up. It was based on final salaries, and this is basically, that's the proportion of his final salary. So that's how final salaries work. The scheme that we're going to see is going to be not based on that model. It's going to be based on how much you put in, and you get a proportion of that, which some people say is fairer.
And sustainable, because the point is, isn't it, that what's the vibe? I mean, is the scheme unsustainable? Is that a scare tactic to sort of try and make cuts? Or is it genuinely pretty difficult to service such a generous system?
There's a massive deficit. There's a £7 billion deficit, and possibly an even bigger deficit once you change the way the investments are structured. So something needs to be done, and some people who might have been expecting a very big pension are going to see some big cuts.
Well, all the details, as we say, including several other scenarios played out for you on page six and seven this week. Holly, moving on, you got your hands on some data this week showing how long it takes to set up clinical trials. It seems industry-funded trials are quicker moving than those funded by other means, research councils, charities and so on.
Yeah, that's right. This is some data from the National Institutes of Health, which shows exactly that. And it's something that researchers have said to me before, that they often complain that the bureaucracy and the time it takes to get certain approvals needed to do research within the NHS can really mount up. And so we got our hands on some data and seemed to find that academics were getting their trials approved and set up slightly slower than those that were funded by industry. Now, in extreme cases, some academics say it can take up to a year for this these trials and approvals to be put in place before research can start, which can have a negative effect on the trial itself. You might need to get more funding to extend it, to get it to complete. Mm. Yeah, so, I mean, people have offered various reasons for why this is the case, that these academic trials perhaps take a bit longer to set up. Some say that academic research is looking at largely at things that drug companies might not fund. So it might tend to be rarer diseases, which might make it harder to find people to include in the trial. And also that the trials are coming more complicated in terms of the patients that that researchers want to use, especially in cancer research. And a spokesperson from the National Institutes for Health Research, Clinical Research Network, says it's because simply commercial companies have big teams of people who are paid to push these things along and get everything involved quicker, which obviously academics don't have the luxury of.
But perhaps they should do. I mean, it's not going to hold much water, is it, with people who say, well, the quicker these trials get going, the quicker we get products on the shelf that are actually going to going to benefit people. And it must be quite frustrating both for the consumer and for the researcher to not be able to just kick on and get going.
Yeah, and that's the case. But we should probably mention here that, as we've written on before, there are some sort of initiatives in place to try and speed up and streamline this approval process for everybody, so commercial and non-commercial trials. There's 4.5 billion, million, I think, that the NHS Health Research Authority is investing in this over the next few years. So hopefully these really long delays could be a thing of the past.
I mean, it's noteworthy, isn't it, that this comes out in the same week as the all this stuff on the Ebola
viruses. Yeah, exactly.
Viruses,
yeah, crisis can really speed things up.
Exactly, which are going through at really breakneck speed. So it shows it can be done if people really want it to. Actually, Holly, I think you said the data was from the NIH. I think we should probably clarify it's from the NIHR. American data, it is UK data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for that clarification, Paul. The full story's on page 8 this week. Do check it out. Paul, back to you, actually. Our cover feature this week is about postgraduate funding, specifically students wishing to progress to master's degree courses but who are perhaps held back by a lack of state finance, a lack of government money. It's something you've looked at quite closely.
Yeah, it is indeed. I mean, I've looked at it partly with a view to the fact that the autumn statement's coming up in December, where the government has apparently committed itself to coming up with some kind of solution to all of this. Although Greg Clark's most recent remarks at Universities UK suggest that they don't have an answer. But anyway, there it is. Perhaps reading this feature will help concentrate his mind. I've run through, some of the options. I mean, the most obvious one, which has been around for a while, is the idea, obviously, of a state-funded student loan scheme for postgraduates, either extending the undergraduate one to postgraduates or more likely setting up some slightly different variation on that. One popular idea that Tim Loyner came up with a few years ago and which is still quite highly thought of is that postgraduates would repay the proportion of their income between 15,000, which was roughly was the threshold for the old undergraduate loan scheme, and the 21,000 that it's gone up to with the new one. So they wouldn't sort of be paying sort of dole, as it were. They'd be paying their postgraduate debt out of a different proportion of their
hit them sooner
income. There'll be a lower threshold. Yeah. On the other hand, all the data suggests that they'll be earning more than people with only undergraduate degrees. So you would hopefully not be hitting the poor. So that's one of the examples. Of course, Hafke is running lots of pilots on this at the moment. There are all kinds of schemes in its postgraduate support scheme. A lot of them involve scholarships, but there are loan schemes in there as well. There's even a credit union that Durham University is looking at. So there are lots of ideas there. I suppose the question is whether the government sort of settles for one or whether it does a sort of bit of this and a bit of that. A lot of people seem to think that the latter, though messier for government, might actually be the best way to address all the problems that there are.
Sure. I know I wrote a bit about, I think Cranfield was one of those Hefke funded ones, just trying stuff out. But I mean, what happens now for your master's student? I mean, are they heading to the bank? If the bank of mum and dad doesn't work, are they off to a traditional banking lender, and how are they sort of receiving them when they, you know, ask for some cash to fund more study?
Well, they get pretty short shrift, really. I mean, there is a professional and career development loan scheme there, the government contribution to which just involves repaying the interest on it while the student's at university. But after that, you're pretty much on your own, and with repayment rates of 9.9% a year, it's not very popular, particularly with students who aren't on, you know, a track to high-paying jobs in business or law or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, private lenders tend to only, from what I've seen, they tend to only give the loans out if people are going to business or law or engineering. And if you go to them and say, I want to study medieval history and possibly get a job as an academic in future, they're not going to be hammering down your door to give you money to do that, are they?
No, I'm sure that's right. And there are a few alternative finance schemes sort of setting up as well, but I think pretty much the same applies to them as well. They're very much aimed at the more lucrative end of the master's market. So there clearly is a problem there. Quite what the problem is another question. I mean, is it a question of widening participation or something else? I mean, the point is made by a couple of people in the article that, you know, by the time people have done an undergraduate degree, they're already sort of 21 and almost certainly not living at home. Lots of people who do master's degrees, of course, are a lot older than that. So, you know, how exactly do you assess the sort of access issue, given that parental income and that kind of thing is no longer a sort of reliable metric on that?
Yeah, food for thought for Greg Clark and and for our readership as well. The 2015 THE Best University Workplace Survey is now live online, at least I hope it is. As we record this, the technicians are doing their thing, but I believe it will be live online now. We've published in this week's magazine a few findings from last year's survey. Found that academics are about half as likely to feel that their job gives them a healthy work-life balance compared to those in professional and support roles. And we drilled down a little bit further as well to look at sort of which departments find themselves most overworked. I said at the beginning of the show I'd let you know, so I'll be good on that and tell you that academics who describe themselves as arts and humanities scholars were the most likely to feel that their work commitments prevented them from enjoying a healthy work-life balance, some 56% of respondents to last year's survey. Scholars in the creative arts were next up, and social sciences after that. In fact, interesting, one social scientist who spoke to us as part of the survey said that he hadn't taken any annual leave in the 8 years that he'd been in his role at a Russell Group university in the north. We have a few more excerpts in the story on page 7 from people who took part last year. At the other end of the scale, just to complete the circle, as it were, it's academics in engineering and technology who are the least likely to feel their work prevents them having a work-life balance, followed by those identifying as maths or science scholars. But that's all to be read up at your leisure on the website and in the magazine this week. The most important thing I'd like to say is if you do have 5 or 10 minutes spare, please do head to timeshighereducation.co.uk/best-uni-workplace and fill in our survey there. It really does help us to build a picture of what working life is like in UK universities, but we need your help and support to do that, so do head along there. That's all though for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. You'll find us as ever on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn and Google+ as well. If there's anything you'd like to say, do get in touch. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.